Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Picture an African elephant. They're the big ones, with males standing up to 13 feet at the shoulder and weighing as much as three Ford F-150s. In the wild, their sheer size is a deterrent to many potential predators. But size is no problem for human poachers, who between 2009 and 2012 slaughtered 100,000 African elephants for their tusks and continue killing at a rate of about 30,000 a year. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. If those numbers sound unsustainable to you, they are. Mozambique has lost fully 48% of its elephant population over the past 5 years. Tanzania has lost 60%. And not only are ivory poachers bringing these animals close to extinction, they are using the proceeds to bankroll terrorist groups that threaten countless human lives. Brian Christie is chief correspondent and founder of the Special Investigations Unit at National Geographic. In his article for the September issue of the magazine, he writes about the poaching problem and about his bold plan to follow the killers and their product to markets where it is traded. Brian, welcome back to Think.
Chris, it's great to be here. Thank you.
It really is unfathomable to think about how many elephants are being killed right now. How long can this go on before Africa has no wild elephants left?
Well, you're right. It's a bloodbath, and elephants. I did the cover story in 2012 on the elephant poaching crisis. And what's very sad to me is elephants. I went to places where elephants were safe to be able to photograph those elephants, and now all of those elephants are gone. It's year on year massive slaughter.
And to be clear about what you just said, many of the animals under the attack right now are living on national parklands, places set aside to preserve a habitat for them.
That's absolutely right. And that's one of the main insights of this project is the level of violence being directed at rangers on the ground in these parks. These parks are under siege.
Why are poachers not impaired by the presence of those park rangers?
Well, this project focuses on something new. Most people looking at the ivory trafficking problem, the elephant poaching problem, have been looking at East Africa. In East Africa, there's a problem of rangers not being paid well enough. Some of those rangers, there's a huge corruption problem, and some of those rangers are involved in the poaching game. In Central Africa, where we focus this project, it's very different. In Central Africa, there are terrorist organizations and rebel militias poaching elephants and doing the things that terrorist groups in Central Africa do. They're kidnapping children to turn them into boy soldiers. They're raping women. They're committing extraordinary atrocities against the people who live in the areas of these parks. And so the park rangers are there not only protecting elephants but protecting the people, and they're being killed for it.
Hmm. So a country like Sudan that has no naturally occurring elephants within its territory has become this haven for those who poach abroad.
That's right. One of the big points of this story is that Sudan has become home and host to terrorists and rebel militias operating mostly out of the Darfur region that people have been hearing about. This is the Darfur region we've been hearing about since about 2003, the atrocities committed there. 400,000 people have died in that region, millions of people displaced. That same area, that area that George Clooney's been talking so much about, is home and host to rebel militia called the Janjaweed, who are on horseback and moving out of Sudan across the continent, poaching all the way across to West Africa, 900 miles on horseback to go after the elephants. And there's a pocket in Darfur where Joseph Kony, head of the Lord's Resistance Army, and his militia are living with the support of the Sudanese government.
Kony has found that he can trade poached ivory directly with the Sudanese military for weapons.
Yeah, we spent the last 2 years locating and interviewing ex-child soldiers, people who had recently defected. In fact, one who had just defected from an active poaching mission for the Lord's Resistance Army, and they described to me exactly how Kony and his men operate, how they poach the elephants in Garamba National Park in the Congo, and then they walk. It's extraordinary. They walk the equivalent of through the jungle from Washington, D.C. to Detroit, to a section of Sudan where they find safe haven, and then they're trading with the military of Sudan for arms and for medicine.
This is Michael Onan that you're talking about, who had broken away from Kony's militia. Tell us his story.
So Michael Onan is a young man. He had been kidnapped himself as a child soldier and defected last September after years in Kony's military. And the interesting thing about Onan is that he's small. And so instead of being assigned to carry things the way most of, or to be a soldier the way most of Kony's men are, he was made a radio operator. So he was privy to Kony's secret communications for years. And when he defected to the African Union forces operating in that area. And I was able to talk to him, and he described for me a poaching operation that had just happened in Garamba. 25 elephants had been killed, and they were moving the ivory north on their way to Sudan.
Kony seems to have a particular fascination with ivory as a source of income. Is it just about the monetary value, or is there something symbolic in it for him?
I think for him it is a war resource. People talk about him trafficking in gold and other efforts to get to diamonds, other natural resources in Africa. What makes ivory appealing for a guy like him is that all it takes to get ivory, unlike what it takes to get gold or diamonds, all it takes to get ivory is an AK-47. And that's what his men have in abundance.
Brian, does Joseph Kony have true believers in his organization, or is it mostly kidnapped people who eventually are sort of, you know, by Stockholm syndrome, converted to the ways of thinking that, he has put out there?
I think it's the spectrum. I mean, it's certainly, I mean, these people are brutalized to become his parts of his militia. Some very senior defections recently. Some of those people I've spent time with, and to be in the presence of some of these guys is to be in the presence of, from my impression, true evil. So you have a range of the victims who are remain victims, even as they're made into soldiers, and those that are too far lost.
And of course, some of these soldiers that are able to get away and are still children are feared by their families forever after.
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, so I spent time in the villages where these children had been kidnapped from and turned into soldiers, and was able to spend time with people who had returned, who'd escaped or been let go. And one of the things that Kony does is he'll kidnap kids, use them as porters and worse, and then as he moves to the next village, release the previous group so that he can remain pretty quick on his feet and doesn't have to feed as many people and that sort of thing. But when they come back, they're both very welcomed, surprisingly welcomed for people who have maybe attacked that same area, but also feared. The girls are. It's assumed that they'd been raped, and they have difficulty finding husbands. I spent time with one boy in particular who had been a killer, and it was the most difficult interview I had for this film.
Are the people who are doing this, Brian, I mean, these children, when they come back, they've been released, how self-aware are they? I would imagine a lot of these individuals have come from places where they don't get a lot of education, but are they as aware as you and I would be of the potential for psychological damage from these experiences?
You're taking me outside of my area of expertise, but my you know, what people there have to live with day to day in terms of the threat of violence, whether it be from Lloyd's Resistance Army, from their own militias, from their own armed forces. We read regularly about crimes committed by the armed forces in some of these countries. This is where park rangers represent the only order and safety that some of these people experience. This one boy who acknowledged that he was a teenager and he had been assigned to kill humans, and I had to ask him, because this is an elephant and ivory trafficking project, you know, how about killing elephants? And he just puts his head down in frustration and says, "Don't you understand that we were killing, killing, killing? I killed people. There were other people killing elephants." And it was more, he was challenging me to try to understand things rather than me sort of helping him to understand things.
Hmm. What do you know about the partnership that Kony is said to be pursuing with Boko Haram?
So Dominic Ongwen is one of Kony's most senior officials. He is wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, as is Kony. And Ongwen defected earlier this year, and he reports that Kony is interested in forging an alliance with Boko Haram. We've seen reports in the last 6 months or so that Boko Haram is in turn trying to forge alliances with ISIS, calling itself West Africa's ISIS. Kony is reaching out to other terrorist groups. Seleka is a horrible group operating in Central African Republic. And Ongwen reports how these groups are forging relationships and how ivory is one of the reasons Kony has reached out to these other groups.
What happens to the bodies of elephants slaughtered for ivory?
In most cases, they're abandoned. They take the two tusks and go. They're using chainsaws in some cases to be even faster, to just cut the front of the elephant off. Some people, that's one of the things that I'm asked by people on the street, you know, or they'll say to me, the elephant poaching problem, you know, people in Africa are so poor, I can understand it. And that's not what I'm addressing in this investigation. I'm looking at commercial scale criminal activity. I'm looking at organized crime operating in East Africa, and I'm looking at terrorist groups operating in Central Africa. And that's very different.
So you had the idea to use a little GPS tracking device to trace black market ivory trade. We'll talk about your challenge in getting something that is not real ivory to look like a severed tusk. But how did you come up with this idea?
Once you start looking at this as a criminal activity and not an animal activity, you start asking yourself, okay, what tools would we use if we were trying to infiltrate a drug syndicate or an arms trafficking syndicate? And one of the things that comes pretty quickly to mind is, okay, these guys are moving ivory, but to them it's money. So if we knew they were going to ship money and we knew roughly where they were picking up the money, and that they were putting in a certain kind of box, what if we could put a tracker in that box? What if we could put a tracker in with their money and see where it goes? And that's the foundation for the idea of putting a tracker inside a fake tusk.
Brian Christie is with us. Warlords of Ivory premieres August 30th on the National Geographic Channel. He's also got a story in the September issue of the magazine about how killing elephants finances terror in Africa. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes. Join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest for the hour is Brian Christie, chief correspondent and founder of the Special Investigations Unit at National Geographic. There's an article in the September issue of the magazine about how killing elephants finances terror in Africa. There's also an upcoming documentary called Warlords of Ivory that premieres August 30th on the National Geographic channel. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can email think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Brian, you need a decoy tusk, essentially, and this thing has to be really convincing because you're going to be handing this thing off to someone who presumably has dealt with thousands of tusks over time. What attributes did your fabricated tusk have to have?
Yeah, this was one of the most exciting elements of this project. I had tried to do this a few years ago. I had the idea of creating a fake tusk and trying to put some sort of tracking device inside. And I sent out bids to some museums and taxidermists, and nothing that came back. Things looked real, but they didn't feel real. Ivory is a very unique material, and it's one reason people like to carve it. It's very dense. It has a sound. If you knock ivory against another piece of ivory, it has a ring that you don't hear from other materials. I did a project this year on taxidermy, and it put me in touch with the world's best taxidermists. And one of those guys, George Dante, is the taxidermist for the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And I said, George, I'd like you to build me a fake elephant tusk that has the look and feel of a real one. And he said, Brian, no one's ever done this before, but I'll try. And he did an extraordinary job.
If you are, one would assume that you could use something like plastic because that's what's used now in a lot of applications that used to call for ivory. There are plastic composites, but plastic or resin would burn if you melted it.
Right.
So or would we melt used... if you burned it, excuse me.
Yeah. No, and that's one of the things. So ivory traffickers, to test whether ivory is real, will scratch it or try to burn it with a lighter. And we had to come up with something that was dense enough to pass that test. George hand-painted each one of these tusks in exquisite detail. I collected dirt from an area that I knew was heavily poached, and it was a uniquely red dirt. And I carried that dirt with me and used it to muddy the tusks so that they looked as if they'd been buried. One of the things ivory traffickers do is they'll kill the elephant, get on a motorbike, take the tusks to a safe place, bury the tusks until they've gathered, killed enough elephants to make it worthwhile, take it to an aggregator, and it moves up just like a classic organized crime network.
And then you need a GPS device that is going to keep working for some time without being charged up in any way.
Right. So we have two real challenges. The first challenge is, can we design a believable tusk that I can hold in my hands and hand to a guy who's in the illegal ivory business and have him believe that's ivory and believe it so well that he's going to hand me money for that? That's the test. And then part two is, inside this thing, I need to have some sort of tracking system. We located a guy in California who'd been building cutting-edge tracking devices for use on collaring all sorts of animals, the Tasmanian devil, pythons being studied in the Everglades, the condor. And he built me a satellite-based GPS tracking system that was laid inside this these fake tusks, and is basically a satellite phone that called me twice a day from anywhere in the world.
And you discovered in Tanzania that the decoy was good.
Yes. So one of the things, you know, and not all the, you try to plan, but one of the things that I was a little late to realize is, if you're moving around the world with things that look exactly like ivory, you are potentially an ivory trafficker. And I was moving through Tanzania, through the Dar es Salaam, and they asked me, as you do at an airport, put your luggage on the conveyor belt for the X-ray, and mine went through, and the man started. I could see he was studying the screen, and he said, "Open that bag." And I opened the bag and lift out this tusk, and I'm saying, you know, kind of, this isn't what it looks like.
Likely story, right?
Right. I have a National Geographic ball cap on. I have the magazine from a prior issue that I've written about ivory, and I'm handing him all this stuff. At the same time, police are swarming from across the airport, and they look at the tusk, and half of them say, "No, this guy is an ivory trafficker." And the other half are looking at the X-ray screen, and they're saying, no, he's not an ivory trafficker. Look at that. Look at the electronics. This guy has a bomb that he's trying to get on the plane.
Wow.
And, yeah, so they brought they had me wait until their wildlife expert arrived, and he looked at the tusk, and he, you know, turned it around and around, and he pointed at me, and he said, "You are a liar, Buana. And you are trying to lie in front of all of these people. I have never been wrong in 10 years. This is a real ivory tusk." So I spent a night in police custody, and George Dante, the taxidermist, couldn't have been happier.
I mean, were you surprised that you were apprehended? Do you think that they were hoping that you would also have a suitcase packed with $100 bills to pass around?
I didn't offer to bribe anyone, but I did try to see if anyone was sort of giving me a wink, wink, nod, nod moment to open that door, mostly as a journalist, to be able to. You know, this was, for me, this sounds like a terrible thing. You've been arrested and things. But for me as a journalist, it was very exciting. Oh, I'm going to get to see the inside process of being arrested. And I'm going to get to meet a lot of wildlife officials that normally would take me weeks to get into a room to sit down with. Now they're all coming to see me. So I was surprised, especially given Tanzania's reputation. Just a few weeks ago, some Chinese went through that exact same airport and had paid off some Tanzanian airport officials and weren't arrested until they got to Switzerland.
How did you finally convince them that you were indeed a counterfeit ivory carrier?
It was a combination of you can't lose your sense of humor at these moments. So when they took me to where I was going to be kept overnight, they pointed to this little plastic chair. I said, "Where am I going to sleep?" They pointed to that chair, and I said, "Well, where's my guard stay?" And they pointed to this chair that was worse. And I said, "Well, this isn't fair." And they all bristled and said, "What do you mean this isn't fair? You're a criminal." And I said, no, it's not fair that I get the nicer chair. My guard, I'm the criminal. I should have to sleep in the bad chair. And they all laughed at that. And you know, humor is, you have to maintain your sense of humor in moments like this. So that was part of it. That helped with the tone. And then the U.S. Embassy was very helpful as well.
I mean, at what point did you have to call your editor and say, "We have a problem here in Tanzania"?
I made that call. This was a very eye-opening thing. I made that call pretty early on, about 3 hours into the interrogation, I would say. I had access to my phone, and this is my editor at National Geographic, and National Geographic editors are active. So this, I found him. The good news is my call went through and I got to talk to him. The bad news is he was on a mountain in Colorado. And so all I heard was, "Brian, I can't hear you. I'll call you back later." So that was the extent of my support at that moment.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Riley on the line in Dallas. Hi, Riley.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
All right, my question is for Brian. I've just heard the story on the way home from work, and it's fascinating. And I've always thought since I was a child how horrible it is, the poaching of elephants, and just want to know if there's anything that can be done that I could do or anyone here could do to hopefully try to stop this so their elephants don't go extinct, if there is anything. And also, just I'm looking for the on the TV and when the program's going to air, and I can't find it, so if you could remind us.
It's August 30th is the program, Warlords of Ivory. And
okay,
cool. As to the other question, Brian, what can we do from here?
Yeah, I think one of the most important things, and it sounds small, but it's actually not, is share this story. It's amazing how many people don't know. People are aware of that elephants are under pressure, but what they don't know is the level of violence involved in the ivory trade, and they don't know that rangers are being killed, not just for elephants, but because they represent the only order many of these places have. So terrorist groups are killing these people to get not only to the elephants, but to get to the children living in the villages, to get to foodstuffs that they would have in their homes. So sharing this story is surprisingly powerful. And, you know, the big problem country is China. China's consumption of ivory is what's driving most of this illegal trade. And China has very recently announced that it will do away with its domestic ivory market. The only reason they've made that announcement is because people have shared these stories over the last 3 years with growing intensity. When you share these stories, you start to activate other people in the ecosystem, politicians and others who can take action.
This may be something you haven't looked at, Brian, but is it possible to somehow fabricate ivory in a lab setting in the same way that people can grow bone tissue in a lab and not harm an animal at all?
I don't know about ivory. They're experimenting in that way with rhino horn. Rhino are under very similar pressures in South Africa, and there are efforts to reproduce rhino horn with 3D printers and DNA technology, and it's a very controversial question whether you start producing genetically indistinguishable material and put it out there. Yes, it's not from an endangered species, but it confuses the question whether, you know, if you arrest somebody, that person can say, no, this is not from the endangered species. I bought this at the online from the 3D printer program, and it gets very complicated. Particularly, the boogeyman in all of this is corruption. You can't look at the economics of let's flood the market with this or that and drive down the price and things. It doesn't work the way normal economics would because of the level of corruption throughout these industries.
How did you go about finding someone who would be willing to place this fake tusk for you to the extent that it would be traded or at least moved with other pieces of real ivory?
So we experimented over months with a variety of ways to get ivory into the system. You know, you can do a hand-to-hand transaction. You can put ivory on the back of a motorbike the way a sort of bush trafficker would, and then wreck that motorbike and leave it in a place. You could drop it out of an airplane into an area that you know is frequented by traffickers. And we're keeping tight for security reasons of those involved, exactly how we do it. But those are, you know, there's quite a range of ways to get things into the system.
So you had no guarantees initially that this would actually work, but you were able to ascertain after some time that, if nothing else, the GPS tracker was working and the ivory was moving.
Yeah, it was very exciting. I mean, at first, nothing moved. Things just sat. And, you know, as a criminal investigator, you you have to constantly be moving forward. You can't get down when things don't go well. There's always going to be a problem. Things are always going to go wrong. And your only mistake would be if you're surprised by that. If you accept that things will go wrong in your investigation, you can just keep moving forward. So we were moving forward on other fronts, following the money, doing financial transaction analysis and that sort of thing. And then all of a sudden, on my Google Earth program, I watch my tusks move, and in the story, the magazine story, I write about it like watching a bobber on a lake suddenly get a nibble and then take off. And we hooked a huge fish, in that these things proceed directly north from the Central African Republic into South Sudan and then into Sudan to an area where I was told before this even began that is where Kony is likely to be, and it's where his men trade with the Sudanese armed forces. And our ivory went directly to that spot.
So what do you do with that information?
Well, we tell the story. I mean, the important thing as journalists is to get that story out and trust that other people in the ecosystem of international law enforcement will act on that. I mean, this is a sort of unusual circumstance because the government of the country that our ivory went to is in bed with the terrorist organization that may well have been moving that ivory. So there was no sort of cop to run to.
Brian Christie is my guest. He's chief correspondent and founder of the Special Investigations Unit at National Geographic. His article about how killing elephants finances terror in Africa appears in the September issue of National Geographic. There's a related documentary on the National Geographic channel called Warlords of Ivory that premieres August 30th. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, talking this hour with National Geographic's chief correspondent and founder of its Special Investigations Unit, Brian Christie. You can read his article about how killing elephants finances terror in Africa in the September issue of the magazine. Join the conversation at 800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. That's where we hear from a listener who wants to know how effective is painting the elephant tusk, or sometimes people talk about staining tusks, so that they lose their value.
Yeah, I hear that from time to time. The challenge is that the paint can easily be peeled off, that carvers will... I've spent a lot of time in the carving factories in China, and that you can take off that outer layer of paint. One of the things that recently someone proposed to me that I haven't explored is can we use tetracycline or some other... Remember when tetracycline was a problem of staining your teeth if too much of it was introduced to you? And I wonder about things like that, whether there's a safe way to get something into an elephant system that would stain its teeth from a deep level. I don't know the answer to that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Bruce in Arlington. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I was wondering if it's kind of, I think it's a little bit futile to try to address stop poaching with laws or whatnot if you don't first address climate change, where we have a whole industry based on around fossil fuels, which kind of destroys natural resources in the areas. And, you know, just like poaching is just part of the economic system of trying to, these people, the Africans themselves, they care about these animals, but the whole society is based around still destroying natural resources in the area, which I think is a bigger threat because of that. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. Brian, does that apply here when we're talking about poaching to fund terrorism?
Well, I think it's part of the same issue. So the destruction of elephants, pulling elephants out of an ecosystem, biologists will tell you, is a face of negative climate change. It is to pull the architect, they call them the architect of their environment. You know, these guys take down trees, they spread seeds with the manure. And so losing animals in that way is part of that same issue. And then more specifically, you know, you take the fight in front of you, and the fight in front of me for the last several years has been the ivory trade and just the terrible plummeting of elephant populations. And so we wanted at National Geographic to do something aggressive and something creative to take on that challenge.
What does Joseph Kony want exactly?
Well, what he tells his men and what he has said in his rare public statements is that he wants to overthrow the government in Uganda on behalf of his Acholi people, who are the people of northern Uganda. And he wants to do it. And he says that he is conducting himself according to the Ten Commandments. He's a former altar boy as a child. And, of course, he's a psychopath. His men at his orders have cut the lips and ears off of people. They've cut the feet off of people found riding a bicycle, because apparently that violates his code. It's a very Hitler-like behavior.
You end the piece almost with a cliffhanger, like, you know, at this writing, we know that this ivory is here, this fake ivory is here. It could have moved by then. Has it, in fact, have you had indications that it's moved since you finished writing the article for National Geographic?
Well, now you're asking, you know, the show is on Sunday, Chris, at 8 o'clock.
All right. So that that question will be answered in the show. Are you promising us?
No, I'm not promising it. So the tusks in the show last communicated in the spring, and they've gone silent since then, but they've gone silent in the past, and there can be a number of reasons for that. The batteries could have died, although the calculations suggest they can continue for several more months. They could have been discovered and destroyed. We have a digital thermometer in the tusks that I can also read, and that thermometer says they're in a place a couple of degrees cooler than the average temperature in Sudan at the moment. And that suggests they may be buried or inside a building. If they're in a container, it's unlikely I can get a signal, and that could have them dark for a few months. So there are a number of reasons both positive and negative, I may not have heard from them yet. And we're also these aren't the only two we're working with, but they are the two focused in the story.
Will you know when the fake has been discovered? Will you know when someone's aware that this is not a real tusk?
No, that's so, I mean, one of my hopes is to see them go to an address in Hong Kong or Beijing and for me to get on a plane and then show up at that address. That's sort of the wish list moment. But otherwise, if they just go dark and I've lost them, I mean, I know the house. I know the house that they were last seen in.
You got like a satellite photo, right?
I contracted with a satellite company at one point to take a shot of where they were in transit. And we have that both in the film and the story.
If you show up in China, are you still dealing with people who are willing to kill to protect their quote-unquote business?
Well, from my perspective, you're definitely showing up at the door of some very bad people. Hmm. And, I mean, this is one of the things that with lots of resource-based crime, when you get at the very other end, people have convinced themselves that they're not part of the crime. They're not part of the killing going on in Africa. And in fact, they are. those would be that those people would be part of a much more business-like criminal syndicate.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Julia on the line in Dallas. Hi, Julia.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest if there has ever been an effort to raise elephants or select four elephants that don't have tusks so that they would not be targets for poachers.
So that's an interesting question. One of the, again, I'm not a biologist. Tusks are important to elephants, and their social structures and their daily lives. But one of the things we are seeing is because poachers are taking the biggest elephants out first when they can, we are seeing over time smaller and smaller tusk sizes. And one of the negative implications of that is that these tuskless or small tusk elephants are often have to compensate and become more violent. And so you're seeing conflicts in herds by elephants. And one of the ideas is that this is because their tusks are smaller and they have to assert themselves in other ways.
That's fascinating. So there's like a weird unintended evolutionary consequence to this.
Yeah, collateral damage. Yeah.
Huh. All right, let's go back to the phones. Now we have Ngate in Dallas. Hi, Ngate.
Hi, how you doing? Just I need to ask him or a comment. There's a lot of emphasis on poaching and ivory trading, but the forest or the habitat of those elephants and the other animals, the forests are gone. There is few left. What does the international community do about it? Down the road, 30 years or maybe 20 years, there will not be a forest in Africa to be habitat for these animals. Are you guys looking this or what we need to do about it?
Thanks for your call.
Well, he's absolutely right that the human pressures on elephant population, elephant habitat, are increasing all the time as population in Africa grows. What we're focusing on in this story, however, is are areas of Africa that are enormous. Garamba National Park, which is one of the hot spots I go to. In this project, we go to the worst of the worst places in terms of poaching and human-on-human crime. And Garamba National Park is about the size of the Grand Canyon, and it is down to just about 1,500 elephants from a population of thousands historically. And so the people there, the guards on the ground, one of the first things they say to me is, we protect the elephants in order to save the park. If the elephants go, then the international community's support for these places is going to disappear. No one's protecting just land. If the land goes, we've lost our heart here. And their idea is that as long as they can protect some elephants, they can get the support they need to protect the land, and then over time they can repopulate the lost species in those parks.
Did you meet rangers at Garamba or elsewhere that were there for much more than the paycheck? I mean, this is dangerous work. They know that they might be killed or wounded. Are there those who would be there regardless because they care passionately about these animals?
Absolutely. I mean, I had the honor of spending time with these men who go out day after day. They're given in the morning just a handful of bullets. It's like a moment out of Jack and the Beanstalk, you know, a handful of beans, and they're using weapons in many cases that don't fire a third of the time. They're seized from poachers, and these guys are going out. They're not going out for the paycheck. I mean, I spent time with a boy whose father had been killed by Sudanese poachers, and he joined the Rangers to continue the fight that his father led. I've met Rangers who talk about being taught by their fathers to appreciate wildlife and wanting to continue that tradition in the face of exploitation, not just by local poachers, but, you know, in places like Virunga National Park, you have outside oil exploration. It's putting pressure on that park. There's lots of pressures that these guys are pushing back against.
It sounds like there is no silver bullet, or if there is, no one has figured out what it is. But do you think the ideal emphasis on stopping this really should focus on the demand for poached ivory?
I think it certainly. Well, if we take China as the demand country, the major demand country, with growing problems in Vietnam and Laos, problems in Thailand and elsewhere. If we take China out of the ivory game, which is to say it stops its domestic ivory industry and it enforces the law to go after ivory traffickers, you've changed the game. I don't think it's an either-or question. I don't think we have to do either demand or supply or the middleman. I think we need to do all three. And I mean, it's one reason that as a journalist, I've wanted to go after this so aggressively, because journalists are one of the few groups who can cross borders and go after criminals and expose them. But until we see the names of Chinese kingpins in the ivory game, and we don't see those names. Until you've seen those names, the way we see the name Pablo Escobar and the Medellin and Cali cartel and El Chapo out of Mexico when in the drug game, until we start seeing that in the ivory game, we haven't gone far enough.
Can I ask you a strange question? Do you understand what's so special about ivory? I know it's a medium that can be carved into intricate shapes and all that, but when you look at a piece of carved ivory, can you understand why people are willing to commit such violence to possess it?
Well, on the ivory is an extraordinary medium, and when you see ivory carved by a master Chinese carver, it's like looking at a Rembrandt or a Picasso. It's extraordinary. And you can understand why the medium is important to them. It's very soft and malleable, and yet it's hard. It has a whiteness that is pure. It comes from one of the largest animals on the planet, and yet you can hold it in your hand. These are reasons that throughout history, man has been attracted to ivory. On the African side, it's largely a criminal good. A good. If I steal this, which is to say, if I kill this animal and take this ivory, I can make money. So it's a criminal effort, and it remains criminal even at the Chinese end, where it's beautiful. If that's been smuggled ivory, it's the beautiful face of a criminal syndicate.
Brian Christie founded the Special Investigations Unit at National Geographic. His article for the September issue is about how killing elephants finances terror in Africa. There's a documentary called Warlords of Ivory, August 30th on the National Geographic channel. Brian, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered today by Alan Roberts. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.